Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's December 2nd. This is almost your last lecture, but not quite. But it will be your last lecture probably on the urinary system, anyway. And then next time, I'm not going to lecture on digestive system, but I might lecture a little bit on the reproductive system. Because you guys have gone over digestive system in lab pretty much already. So I don't know how much material for digestive system I'll have on the final, maybe a little bit of reproductive system on the final, but mostly that final is going to go through the urinary system, all right? So we're going to concentrate on that material. All right, so just to kind of finish where we left off, this should only take about a minute, right? Make sure you know the anatomy of your nephron. And as a matter of fact, you see on the screen right here, let me start the slideshow for you. Make sure that you can break the nephron down into its basic elements, one of two kinds, either tubular elements or vascular elements. Which one of these have a filtrate in them? Tubular elements have filtrate, right? And the other tubes contain blood, and we call those the vascular elements, right? And so there's going to be an interaction between tubular elements and vascular elements, but of course make sure you know the structure of the nephron and what the structural and functional unit of urine formation is, right? So here we got a nephron, and what am I drawing out right here? Vascular element or tubular element? It's a tubular element, namely what? Bowman's capsule. And then we got proximal convoluted tubule. You guys got to catch up here. This is... I hear a little confusion. You guys should have this on the tip of your tongue. Oh, I left something out. DCT right here. All right, and then guess what we got? Yeah, we got G right here, and then that comes out. And then we've got, oh, wow, I forgot to bring markers down here. All right, they're turning out to be a white line. Bummer. All right, so we got the peritubular capillaries. All right, and then that just goes to the renal vein like that. So those of you that are sitting up close, that works. Okay, and then there's three processes. All right, the first process starts here and goes into here. That's one. Another process starts over here and it goes into here. That's two. And then there is another process where there are things in blood and it ends up in the filtrate. That's three. So those are the three functions that you should know. Oh, look at that. Okay. Okay, do they erase? Yeah? Okay, so there we got glomerulus, and I guess this isn't quite red, huh? But this whiteboard might be a little funky. Okay, like that. So that goes to the renal vein. All right, so what are these three processes? This first one is filtration. You can say glomerular filtration if you want. That's not such a big deal, but filtration. The other two, though, I think are pretty important. Tubular, you should say tubular. Tubular. What, reabsorption? R. Tubular reabsorption. All right, and then tubular secretion. And you should know which way materials leave. All right, so which way do materials leave for go for filtration? It goes what? Filtrate to? Blood to filtrate. Reabsorption is filtrate back into the blood, and secretion is blood into the filtrate. And then by the time you get stuff down here in the collecting duct, what do we call that filtrate? That is urine. So that's what we got to talk about today. So that's the structural functional unit of urine formation right there. But we're going to talk about some of the specific properties. So make sure in your mind you can separate the nephron out into vascular elements and tubular elements, right? Then there's the list for you. And then I sent everybody a link where you could practice labeling a nephron, right? And you do that a couple times, you should be able to draw it out. All right, I'm not exactly sure where we are in talking about all these slides right here. So maybe this is a good place to start. Well, there are two kinds of nephrons. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but there are two kinds of nephrons in the kidney. All right, so if we look at the arcuate artery right here, that kind of diagrams what the cortical medullary junction in the kidney. That's the line of demarcation between the cortex and the medulla. And you can see that the renal corpuscle, which is what Bowman's capsule with the glomerulus inside of it, all of them are located in the cortex. None are in the medulla. All right, so the nephron always starts in the cortex. But then we see that there are two different kinds of loops of Henle. There's one, right, that barely goes down into the medulla, and there's another type that dives very deep down into the medulla. So these nephrons that spend very little time in the medulla, we call these cortical nephrons. The ones that have an extended loop of Henle down into the medulla of the kidney, we call these juxtamedullary nephrons. And they do two different kinds of processes. All right, these cortical nephrons pretty much are working all the time, producing a constant type of urine with the same water concentration and salt concentration. All right, so they're just kind of doing their job all the time. Let me get the pointer options going, arrow visible. But these juxtamedullary nephrons are special, for instance, when you become dehydrated. So these are the types of nephrons that can make very concentrated urine with very little volume. So these are the kind that can secrete or excrete a lot of salt from your body without losing a lot of water. So that's why it is they're so important. All right, so that happens under conditions of when you're slightly dehydrated. The kidneys can still do that. Okay, so glomerular filtration, that's the first process right here. All right, that happens in the renal corpuscle. And that's just an association or interaction of the glomerulus with Bowman's capsule. And the glomerulus is a blood vessel. What kind of blood vessel is it?
Fenestrated.
It's a fenestrated blood vessel. But what kind of blood vessel is fenestrated?
Capillary.
Yeah, capillary. So yeah, you're right. All right. So any of you that have taken anatomy know that fenestrations are things that we find in capillaries, which make them pretty leaky. They're large pores right between the endothelial cells of a capillary. And these pores are big enough to allow almost any kind of plasma molecule to pass through it as long as it's small and as long as it's not a protein. All right? And so fenestrated capillaries could be as many as 400 times more leaky compared to a regular capillary, which is what we call a continuous capillary. So here we have the glomerulus, and here is Bowman's capsule. And you should use the model of a serous membrane to understand this Bowman's capsule. So, for instance, how many components does a serous membrane have? How about three? Yeah, there's a parietal division, there is a visceral division, and separating those two divisions of that membrane is serous fluid. All right, so think of the Bowman's capsule as being the same way. So here is the parietal part of Bowman's capsule, and it is continuous with the cells that are inside but touching the glomerulus. So these are Bowman's capsule cells, right? This is not the endothelium of the capillary. It's continuous with Bowman's capsule, the parietal division. So this would be like the visceral cells. This is what we call the visceral division of Bowman's capsule, which is right on the surface of the glomerulus. So if we zoom in to one small segment of the glomerulus, now you can see the endothelium right here, which is what, just a simple squamous epithelium, and all these pores are the fenestrations in the endothelium, and then we can see the podocytes, or the cells that make up the visceral Bowman's capsule, which is right on the surface of the glomerulus. But separating them is a very small basement membrane. So if we even zoom into this region right here, we can look at the feet processes of the podocytes, right, which make up the visceral Bowman's capsule. And sometimes we call this the filtration membrane. Filtration membrane is made out of the capillary endothelium,
a very thin basement membrane, and then the podocytes, and especially the filtration slits between the foot processes of the podocytes. So it's very easy for material to move across this space right here. And what is the motive force? What's moving material from one side of this filtration membrane to the other? Now, you probably have done some filtration already on your way to school today or work. What did you make? Coffee. Yeah, you did. You made that too, but you made like coffee or tea or something, right? And when you make coffee, what's the energy source that you make for, that you use to separate the coffee grounds from all the tiny little molecules that you like to have in coffee? Yeah, you use the filter, but what kind of energy source? Okay, water is a solvent. Water is a solvent, but where do you put the coffee? With respect to the filter, do you put it underneath the filter or on top of the filter? On top, because you're using gravity produces pressure, right? And that pressure forces that fluid through the filter. So you're using a pressure gradient to make coffee. All right, so the same process is happening here. Things will move from blood into the filtrate based on pressure. All right, so this is indeed a filtration step. Okay. All right, so plasma proteins are mostly excluded from the filtrate. Sometimes we call this ultrafiltrate, but filtrate works fine, because they're large and because proteins have a negative charge. The slit diagrams are lined with negative charges as well. And what can you tell me about the same charges? What do exact same charges do for each other? They repel each other, right? So there's like an electrostatic field that prevents proteins from going through the filtration membrane as a result of that. If it's what? If it's a healthy nephron. If it's not a healthy nephron, then of course proteins will move across the filtration membrane. All right? Every once in a while, some proteins, especially albumin, normally can enter the filtrate, but it is resorbed by tubular reabsorption, by receptor-mediated endocytosis, which means that this albumin binds to special receptors in the kidney tubules, and then it is actively put back into the blood. All right, and defects in the filtration membrane or the slit diaphragms results in just a massive leakage of protein into the filtrate, and that then ends up in the urine. All right, and that produces a very frothy kind of urine, kind of looks like soap, right? And that's kind of a sign that there is kidney damage or nephron damage, and we would call that proteinuria when that happens. That should not be a normal occurrence. Here is just a nice scanning electron microscope slide of the glomerulus as it's covered by the different podocytes. And so you can see the foot processes and the filtration slits between these foot processes. And now here is a transmission electron micrograph, even at higher resolution, that shows the lumen of the capillary right here, and you can get a feel for how big this is because it shows the plasma membrane of a red blood cell. Here is one of the fenestrations in the endothelium, then here's the thin basement membrane, and then here are the filtration slits in the podocytes. So that makes up the filtration membrane. All right, so only a fraction of plasma proteins, which are these guys right here, are filtered. Most of them stay in the blood because they're repelled by the filtration membrane. Some are too large to move through, but smaller particles, right, can move right into Bowman's capsule. Right, so now it becomes part of the tubular system of the nephron. All right, so let me read this right here. It's a question. There should be a question mark right there. Name the process by which these small solute molecules enter glomerular filtrate. What's that process that's moving these small molecules right here? It is called? It's due to that pressure gradient, okay? But that name of that process is filtration right there, okay? So that's just filtration. But not only just solute molecules, also solvent molecules leave as well because water is a small molecule, and it can move through those pores very, very easily. Okay. So the volume of filtrate produced by both kidneys per minute, right, is about 115 mLs per minute in women, a little bit higher in men, about 125 mLs per minute in men. So In about 10 minutes, what is that volume equal to? So instead of 125, it would be what? 1,250. What's 1,000 liters in 10 minutes? What's 1,000 milliliters? What's 1,000 milliliters? That's a whole liter. So that's a tremendous amount of fluid. Does anybody have a liter bottle with them? Probably not. I see some smaller ones. That's what? That's 250 mLs, I think. Is that 250 mLs? That's a liter right there. Also, that's like a 500 mL. So that's a liter. So that much fluid you're losing from your cardiovascular system, actually 1.5 that or 1.25 that every 10 minutes is leaving your cardiovascular system. I know it kind of just boggles the mind, because if you were to lose that much water, what should you automatically be thinking about? Okay, well, you're thinking about going to the bathroom for sure, but you're going to be dehydrated, right? Just every 10 minutes. So that, if you actually add that up over the course of the day, that's 180 liters per day, or 45 gallons get filtered through the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. That's a huge water loss. Nobody could actually live through that process without some other processes taking place. Like, what are two other processes that are taking place in the nephron? That's right, reabsorption and secretion. And I think we're first going to focus on reabsorption. So most of that filtered water has to be reabsorbed, or death would ensure from water loss, okay, very quickly. Okay, very, very quickly. So that's how important those kidneys are. All right, so glomerular filtration, we just call that GFR. That's the amount, that's just the rate at which things will be filtered from blood and placed into the filtrate. Is controlled by a couple of different mechanisms, and you should appreciate that's pretty important just by thinking of the volume of water that we're losing by that filtration process. There are extrinsic processes and intrinsic properties. All right, so which ones of these processes, extrinsic or intrinsic, require participation with other organs or other parts of the body? That would be the extrinsic regulation, right? The intrinsic regulation just means that it is a regulatory process that just happens within the kidney, and it doesn't need any kind of outside influence one way or the other. And that's what we call autoregulation, right? If something can autoregulate itself, like the heart can autoregulate itself through the Frank-Starling law, that's an intrinsic mechanism. Doesn't require any hormones or innervation from outside the organ. All right, so vasoconstriction or vasodilation of that afferent arteriole affects the rate of blood flow into the glomerulus and thus the filtration rate. All right, so there are smooth muscles around the afferent arteriole, and when they constrict, what happens to the radius of that arteriole? It decreases, and then what happens to resistance? How does resistance change when the radius decreases? The resistance increases by how much? Just a little bit or a lot? A lot, because why? Yeah, because it's to the fourth power of the radius. Remember that? So small changes in the radius of this afferent arteriole can change the flow through that glomerulus and then the amount of filtrate that's being produced by a large degree. So it's a very sensitive control mechanism. Okay. One way that it happens is through extrinsic mechanisms, and this is through the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so sympathetic nervous activity constricts the afferent arteriole. So what happens to blood flow? If the arteriole constricts, blood flow goes down. That's right. Okay, so that helps maintain blood pressure because it shunts blood to the heart and other muscles. But this might be an exam figure. I can't remember for sure if it is or not. All right, but so let's just start and let's analyze this diagram right here. Okay, so let's just say that the stimulus is a decrease in blood pressure, or you could maybe even start some exercise, right? Start doing some jogging or something, and that's going to activate the sympathetic nervous system. That's going to increase sympathetic tone all over the body, and if it's a decrease in blood pressure, sympathetic activity is stimulated by what? The baroreceptor reflex. Baroreceptor reflex from the medullary centers, increased sympathetic nerve activity. So what are some actions of increasing sympathetic tone? Right, we stimulate the heart, right? Sympathetic nerves go to the heart. What are the two ways that cardiac output will go up? as a result of increasing sympathetic activity on it. The heart rate is going to increase, as well as the stroke volume, right, which is contractility of the heart. So both heart rate and stroke volume will increase, and what's cardiac output? It's just multiplying one times the other, right? So cardiac output will go up because the heart rate and stroke volume will go up. All right, sympathetic nerves to the kidneys cause vasoconstriction of the afferent arterioles that decreases flow into the glomerulus, so that decreases glomerular filtration, and so that decreases urine production. That's going to have a tendency to conserve water in the person's body, so their blood volume will increase. And as their blood volume increases, what's the effect on blood pressure? It's going to increase blood pressure, mostly through the Frank-Starling law, right? Because it increases contractility of the heart. So this is going to subtract from this low blood pressure, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism, right? And as cardiac output goes up, that's going to subtract from the initial stimulus. That's another nice negative feedback mechanism. And then the last thing, sympathetic nerves will cause vasoconstriction in other parts of the body, like the skin and gastrointestinal tract, vasoconstriction within the kidneys that we mentioned before. So the total peripheral resistance of the cardiovascular system increases. So what happens then? If what happens to blood pressure if resistance goes up? Yeah, that's right. Remember that we had to derive that equation. It's not really intuitive, but if you see heart rate going up or stroke volume going up and resistance going up, it's directly related to blood pressure. Okay. So these are nice ways, these are all nice negative feedback mechanisms, extrinsic mechanisms for regulating blood flow through the kidneys, okay, and as a result, blood pressure. Okay, let's talk about the intrinsic mechanisms. All right, so intrinsic is just defined as the ability of the kidneys all by themselves to maintain a relatively constant glomerular filtration rate, even though maybe your blood pressure is fluctuating. Maybe you're changing body position, or maybe it's changing because of diet or a number of different reasons. All right, or maybe there's some kind of cardiovascular insult. Maybe you're hemorrhaging. All right, but we still need to protect glomerular filtration through the kidneys, right, even under all those conditions. All right, so there are two intrinsic mechanisms. One is called the myogenic response, and the other is the tubuloglomerular feedback mechanism. All right, tubuloglomerular means that there is an interaction between the kidney tubules and the glomerulus. All right, so don't forget, the tubules are what? That's a tubular element, but what kind of element is the glomerulus? That's a vascular element. So there's communication between these two different kinds of tubes within the nephron. All right, let's consider the myogenic response first. And then this is myogenic constriction of afferent arterioles due to what? The smooth muscle responding to an increase in arterial blood pressure. So if the arterial, let's forget about the smooth muscles at the afferent arteriole, but if your blood pressure were to increase, if blood pressure increases, what happens to flow through the glomerulus? All right. Remember, flow is directly related to the pressure gradient. So as the pressure increases, the flow through the glomerulus is going to increase. That's going to increase the filtration rate. But if we want to maintain the filtration rate constant, as blood pressure increases for whatever reason, then the smooth muscles of the afferent arteriole automatically start to constrict, increasing resistance, bringing the flow back down to that normal rate. All right, so as they start to stretch, as these smooth muscles start to stretch, they automatically start to contract, right, to kind of overcome that additional driving force of blood through the glomerulus. And I guess that's not such a really big stretch of the imagination, because what happens to your quadriceps muscle if all of a sudden you start to stretch it? What does it do automatically? It contracts, right? It produces that knee-jerk reflex, right? So think of these smooth muscles as sort of operating the same way. If they start to stretch because blood pressure increases, they're going to respond by contracting, right? Regulating the flow into the glomerulus. So that's the myogenic constriction part. Tubular glomerular filtrate, right, is achieved by effects locally, because there are certain chemicals that are produced, and then they're sent to the afferent arterioles. All right, so here is a little synopsis slide that shows glomerular filtration and some things that help control GFR, sympathetic nerves. All right, this is extrinsic, right, activated by the baroreceptor reflex, or maybe by the cardioregulatory center in the medulla, will always constrict the afferent arteriole. And when the afferent arteriole constricts, what happens to glomerular filtration? It decreases, because blood flow through the glomerulus decreases because of that increased resistance. All right, in terms of autoregulation, decreased blood pressure, right? If the driving force of blood through the glomerulus decreases, guess what the smooth muscle does? Relaxes, that dilates, right? And so that maintains constant GFR. But if, on the other hand, if blood pressure increases, then the afferent arteriole constricts, that then maintains GFR within that normal range. So there's no change in GFR. So autoregulation is what kind of regulation? Intrinsic or extrinsic? They're intrinsic. That's right. That's an intrinsic regulation. Okay. All right. So let's talk about that negative feedback between the afferent arteriole and volume of filtrate that's moving through the kidney tubules. And that's what we call tubuloglomerular feedback. Increased flow of filtrate is sensed. So as there's more volume moving through these kidney tubules right here, it's sensed by a special sensing area in the nephron called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And in anatomy, we really don't have time to talk about this very much, but usually we at least mention where it is, right? So if you see juxtaglomerular apparatus, you should be at least thinking kidney, right? And probably nephron. And let's just see exactly where in the nephron it is and break it down into a couple components. All right, so the juxtaglomerular apparatus is in the ascending loop of Henle. All right, so it's going to be in this region right here. And now this diagram kind of fails you a little bit, because in real life, where this ascending loop of Henle really goes is not way out over here someplace, but it actually goes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole. I just don't draw it right there because it would be too messy. All right, so this ascending loop goes right through this region right here, which contains all that smooth muscle in the afferent arteriole. All right, so that can signal the afferent arterioles to constrict if there is high flow through this ascending loop of Henle. Then that will cause constriction of the afferent arteriole that will decrease glomerular filtration and bring the flow of fluid, all right, back down to normal. I have some more slides to talk about, so that's just an introduction to it. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Okay, so what is lost by this filtration step right here? A lot of water and even electrolytes. Salt, potassium chloride, right? Any kind of small glucose, small molecule will be filtered, and it's going to end up in the filtrate, and eventually where is it going to go? Into the urine. Okay. So you don't want to just lose everything. It should be controlled and it should be regulated. All right, so in the proximal convoluted tubule, most of the water, all right, in the filtrate is returned back to the peritubular capillaries. Now, how much water did we lose every day? Yeah, like 45 gallons we lose into the filtrate. So the job of the proximal convoluted tubule is for what? Tubular reabsorption of most of that water. All right, there's no regulation in the proximal convoluted tubule. Right, this proximal convoluted tubule is just doing 100% of its job all the time, absorbing as much or resorbing as much water and salt as possible and glucose as possible. So there's no regulation here. So in your car, that would be like what? Just putting the gas pedal all the way down to the floor and have the engine working 100% full out. So the job of the proximal convoluted tubule is not regulation, it's just to resorb as much water and salt as possible. All right, so at about 180 liters per day of ultrafiltrate produced, right? Only 1 to 2 liters is excreted in the urine every 24 hours, right? So that means what? Most of this, right, 99% of the water that's filtered is resorbed. And most of that takes place in the proximal convoluted tubule. But urine volume does vary according to the needs of the body. Right, so the other parts of the nephron that regulate how much water resorbed is going to be done in the loop of Henle, the distal convoluted tubule, and even the collecting duct. Right, so there's regulation in other parts of the nephron, but the proximal convoluted tubule is just working 100% all the time. Right, so even if you're dehydrated, though, right, there is an obligatory water loss by the kidneys. The kidneys have to excrete 400 mLs per day in order to stay healthy. Otherwise, they start to fail. Right, so even when you're dehydrated, the kidneys have to have that much water available to them. And so that's why, did you read anything about those miners that were trapped underground for months down there in Chile? Okay, they had to regulate. They had a bunch of water, but they thought that they're going to be trapped underground for months and months, and they were. So they drank, right, a very minimal amount every day to last them months, but they still had to drink enough to do what? To maintain the function of their kidneys. You need at least 400 mLs a day of clean water to keep your kidneys healthy. Okay. All right, so resorption of salt and water. So we see the filtration step right here. All right, so here is the beginning of tubular resorption. And the way that tubular resorption works in the proximal convoluted tubules, all right, is that sodium is actively transported out of the tubule, and as a result, water follows with it, right? Because water will go down a concentration gradient. As salt is brought into this interstitial space right here, it becomes very concentrated and solute, so what will water do? It will move into that area as well. All right, so water is never transported. It just moves with other molecules by osmosis. That's important to realize. So let's see exactly how that happens. So we're looking at a proximal tubule in the kidney, and you can say proximal convoluted tubule is fine. And what do we have on this slide? Well, here we have a capillary. All right, now what kind of capillary should this be? If you look at the slide on the drawing on the board. Okay, it kind of looks like a fenestrated capillary, but because I see these like little pores right here, so that's maybe a little misleading, but these pores are just kind of drawn in right here because these spheres are really huge. The sodium and potassium are just drawn huge. They're not really, really big pores in this membrane. But if this is the proximal convoluted tubule, look at the drawing on the board, and what kind of vascular element do you see surrounding a proximal convoluted tubule? And guess what? That's where my marker kind of failed me. All right, what kind of capillaries am I drawing in right here? Is that the glomerulus? Nah, they're the peritubular capillaries. Only the glomerulus has the fenestrations in it. Okay, these peritubular capillaries are really continuous capillaries. All right, so here is the peritubular capillary. We got blood going through it. Then we got a little interstitial space. And then we have the cuboidal cells that make up the proximal convoluted tubule. So it's just a simple cuboidal epithelium. But look at all of these little convolutions on the apical surface of the cell. What does that remind you of? Cilia, could be cilia, but the function of these things is not to beat. The function of this thing is just to make the surface area big. So you can take either end of the cell and start to stretch it out to take all of those convolutions and make it flat so the surface area increases, right? So this is just a way of increasing the surface area of these cells for what particular purpose? When I say surface area, what structure in the room should you think of? A doorway. It's a doorway for what? Exchange. That's right. So now we can have a bigger surface area for exchange, but in particular, we also put these proteins in the apical membrane. This is a co-transporter. All right, so what's going to happen here? All right, let's go over this again. We got blood, We've got an interstitial space. We got the epithelium of the kidney tubule. And here is the lumen of the kidney tubule. And what the heck is in the lumen right here? The filtrate, right? So we have the filtrate. That's the fluid that will eventually become urine, right? But it's not urine yet in the proximal convoluted tubule. It's still filtrate right in there. All right, so co-transport. What the heck does co-transport mean? Can anybody remember what co-transport is? I don't know. I might have to think about that. Co-transport. Help me out. What's co-transport? Is it active or passive?
Active.
It's active, okay. But when we look at this protein right here, do you see any ATP being used? What do we call active transport that doesn't need ATP directly? Secondary active transport. So for secondary active transport, okay, what's being used is a gradient of something. And the gradient that is being produced is high sodium, right, in the lumen of the kidney tubule, low sodium inside the cell. So sodium loves to diffuse inside the cell, and when it does, there's so much energy involved in this, when it does, it can also drag along with it glucose, right? And so hence, this is secondary active transport, but in particular, co-transport or symport, because glucose goes in the same direction. Right, so both sodium and glucose enter the cell. So now we have a high glucose concentration inside the cell, low glucose concentration in this interstitial space. So which way would glucose want to go? If it's high here and low in the interstitial space? Yeah, it's going to go into the interstitial space. It can't get through the membrane, so there has to be a special little facilitated diffuser channel right here that allows glucose to go through. Because remember, glucose is a highly polar molecule. But so we call this facilitated diffusion into the interstitial space. Now, what maintains sodium at a low level inside this proximal tubule cell right here? Here is that sodium-potassium pump. So it's pumping sodium into the interstitial space. So that's maintaining low sodium concentration inside the cell, which means what? It's always going to maintain high sodium in the lumen. So sodium is going to want to diffuse in. And of course, what kind of active transport is this? I see ATP being used up right here. That's primary active transport. So the primary active transporter in the basal lateral membrane right here is driving this whole system. And what molecule is being used up? ATP. As a matter of fact, almost 10% of all the energy that your body uses up every day is used just to drive this pump right here. That's a huge metabolic burden. Okay, so again, that just kind of underscores how important the kidney function is. All right, so here you, oh, look, it says primary active transport. All right, so now you got high sodium in the interstitial space. That will diffuse down its concentration gradient into the blood. So what have you done? Move sodium from the filtrate into the blood. You've done what? Tubular reabsorption of sodium due to the sodium-potassium ATP pump right here. Okay, and also then you end up with high potassium inside the cell. But where should you have high potassium? Inside the cell, okay? And since it's an exchange, right, of sodium and potassium, that doesn't wreck the membrane potential of this epithelial cell. All right, so tubular resorption of sodium is an active process, right? And it's coupled to glucose absorption. So or tubular glucose reabsorption, and since this is a co-transporter, glucose is what? Actively transported, right, out of the filtrate into your body. And what does that mean if it's active transport? Glucose can go from what kind of concentration to what kind of concentration? All right, if it's active transport, it can go from low concentration to high concentration inside your body. So this kind of mechanism right here, as long as these transporters aren't saturated, it can take all of the glucose that's in a filtrate and put it back in your body, because it can go from low to high concentration because it's using ATP as an energy source. All right, and that's perfect, because should there be any glucose left in the filtrate? If it's left in the filtrate, where does it end up? In urine. Should there be any glucose in urine? No, even low concentrations of glucose can be transported back into your body because what? It's an active transport process. As long as this transporter is not saturated, under what conditions might this transporter be saturated? It's going to be filled with glucose and sodium and can't transport anymore. When? Under diabetic, yeah, if somebody has diabetes mellitus, when there's so much glucose in the blood, there's so much glucose that ends up in the filtrate, right, that it saturates the transporters and you can't resorb all of the glucose, so it ends up in urine. And unfortunately, people that have uncontrolled, or some people with uncontrolled diabetes, there's so much sugar in the urine that it actually forms crystals, salt, sugar crystals. And of course, it tastes very sweet. But you did that experiment in lab, didn't you? I hope. You did a taste test for ketones and sugar in urine? No? Should have. I'll have to talk to your lab instructors about that. Okay, so salt and water resorption in the proximal tubule. All right, so solutes are actively transported out, like glucose and sodium, and then water follows just by osmosis. So in this process right here, 1/3 of the original volume, right, is then resorbed and put back in your body. So you don't have to worry about losing that 45 gallons every day. All right, so about 65% of sodium chloride and water is reabsorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule and is returned to the bloodstream. An additional 20% is resorbed in the descending loop of Henle. All right, so now we're up to about 85%, so that of that original volume that was filtered. So you've recovered, so what's 85% of 45 gallons? I don't know, somebody could punch that out on a calculator and tell me how many gallons now of water has been returned to your body. All right, so this is constant in the body. It's not regulated, and it's independent of hydration levels. All right, so that part of the nephron is just working 100% of whatever ability it has all the time. Huh? 38 and a quarter liters, right, are resorbed in that proximal convoluted tubule per day. All right, and the energy cost is about 6% of the calories that you consume at rest. All right, the remaining 15% of water is reabsorbed variably depending on the level of hydration in your body. So if you're dehydrated, the nephron will resorb more of this 15%. If you're well hydrated, then the kidney might elect to excrete the remaining 15% in the urine. All right, and that's going to happen in the distal tubules of the kidney. All right, so what about the collecting duct? That's a distal tubule, right? That comes after the distal convoluted tubule. So the collecting duct plays a very important role in water conservation. It's impermeable to salt, right? And the permeable to water depends, it's regulated, it depends on antidiuretic hormone. And you're kind of familiar with antidiuretic hormone and that it has an effect on the kidney, right? Because what is it? It acts the opposite of a diuretic, right? A diuretic is going to produce urine. Antidiuretic hormone is going to reduce urine volume. All right, so here's a little table, 17.3. All right, as osmolality of blood increases, what state is that? Is that hydration or dehydration? Dehydration, because that means the blood is becoming very salty as the osmolality increases. So there's osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus then can cause an increased secretion of ADH from, where does it come from? The posterior pituitary, right? So the hypothalamus has axons going down into the posterior pituitary, and then ADH will decrease urine volume, which will what? Counteract this increasing osmolality. So increased water retention decreases blood osmolality, bringing it back to normal. And, okay, these other effects right here you can probably just read through, but they're going to be the opposite. They're all going to work through the hypothalamus. Yeah, nice negative feedback mechanism via the hypothalamus controlling release of ADH from the posterior pituitary. Okay, so more importantly, here is a nice flow diagram that kind of illustrates that particular table. And so the osmolality of plasma is, or the homeostasis of osmolality of plasma is maintained by antidiuretic hormone. Again, secreted from the posterior pituitary. Okay, now what does it do? It stimulates the insertion of aquaporins, or these are water channels, right, into the plasma membrane of the collecting ducts. So look where the collecting ducts are over here on the nephron. All right, when ADH is high, H2O is drawn out of the collecting duct. All right, so here's the collecting duct, and there's water in the collecting duct. It can't get out unless there are aquaporins, which are water channels, inserted into the membrane of the collecting duct, and it's the job of antidiuretic hormone to put those aquaporins in. So when the water channels are put in the collecting duct, water can leave. All right, without antidiuretic hormone, those aquaporins aren't there, and that water is going to be lost as urine. All right, so when we have low water intake or dehydration, osmolality increases. That stimulates osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, which then signal the posterior pituitary to increase secretion of ADH, which then travels by the blood to the kidneys. That inserts aquaporins into the collecting duct, and then you have increased water reabsorption. And which way does water move if it's being reabsorbed? Blood to filtrate or filtrate to blood? Reabsorption is filtrate to blood. Okay, so it's being put back in your body. So you have less water excreted in the urine, and what does that do? Less water secreted in the urine, that subtracts from this initial stimulus of dehydration, right? That's going to decrease plasma osmolality. And then if the opposite circumstance happens, right, you still have a nice negative feedback mechanism because ADH secretion is decreased from the posterior pituitary. So you can work through the right-hand side of that flow diagram. All right, now here's a figure that's not in your textbook, all right, but is in your exam figures, which is a nice graphic that shows how ADH is working. So let's look at the anatomy of this diagram first. So here you have a blood vessel, and in particular, it's a capillary. All right, it's like a peritubular capillary that's especially in the medullary part of the collecting duct. All right, so we call that the vasorecta. It's just a special kind of peritubular capillary. All right, so that's in red. Then we have a little interstitial space right here, and that kind of looks. So this looks kind of red or pink to me. This kind of looks gray right here, green. That's the interstitial space. And then you have the endothelial lining of the kidney tubule, in particular a collecting duct, right? So that's just, what, a simple cuboidal epithelium. And then you have the lumen of the collecting duct filled with filtrate, okay? And then we have, so you got filtrate, the wall of the tubule, interstitial space, and then blood that's in your circulation. So these are the four compartments that we're going to look at. And let's look at the osmolality of these various compartments right here. So the filtrate is at 300 milliosmolar, all right, and the osmolality of the collecting duct cell is 600, all right. So what can you tell me about the saltiness of the filtrate compared to the cell? Is the filtrate more salty or less salty? Is less salty, it's a smaller number, more salty inside the cell. So what does that mean for water? Where is water at a high concentration? The less salty place, right? So here you have high water concentration compared to inside the cell, and it's the same as the interstitial space. Now let's look at the blood right here. Look at the osmolality of blood, 700, which means what? It's the most salty of these four compartments. So which way is water going to have a tendency to go? From low to high, if there is a way to get there. All right, water is water a polar compound or nonpolar? Yeah, it's polar. Yeah, it's a polar compound. So does it like to diffuse through membranes all by itself? Absolutely not, because the membrane, remember, is hydrophobic. It doesn't allow water to move through. Okay, unless there are channels that allow water to move through. And if there are channels, then water can at least move right down its concentration gradient from the filtrate into the blood. All right, and so under normal conditions, these channels right here, these right here are what we call aquaporins, are not in the apical surface of this membrane. So let's see how that's regulated. All right, so let's go back to the blood. We have a signaling compound here called vasopressin. And vasopressin is another name for what? Antidiuretic hormone. People use those names interchangeably. And maybe I even had that on a test. I maybe had that on a test before. Vasopressin and antidiuretic hormone. I think I mentioned that before. So here you have ADH, And ADH is a polar compound. It's a hormone that's polar. So it can diffuse out of the capillary into the interstitial space. And since it's a signaling molecule, all right, what does it need to signal this cell right here? How is this cell going to be responsive to ADH or vasopressin? What does it have to have? It's got to have a receptor for it, right? And in the basolateral membrane of this endothelial cell, here is the receptor. All right, now, is this a cytoplasmic receptor or is this a surface receptor? And why? It's a surface receptor because ADH or vasopressin is what? It's a polar molecule. It can't get into the cell, right? So it's got to have a surface receptor. So ADH doesn't enter the cell. It's what we call what? The first messenger. ADH is a first messenger, which through some kind of mechanism right here causes the buildup of a second messenger. In this particular case, it is one that you're really familiar with, which is what? Cyclic AMP. So ADH causes an increase in cyclic AMP, and that will cause a chain of events to take these aquaporins that are stored in reserve in endosomes within the cytoplasm and move these endosomes over to the apical surface of the cell where they fuse together. And now these aquaporins are not inactive on the interior of the cell. They now become active right on the cell membrane surface. And what does that allow water to do? To go down the concentration gradient from the lumen of the filtrate into the cell. All right, so that's what we mean when we say ADH causes the insertion of these aquaporins into the cell membranes of the collecting duct tubules. Okay, so water moves in, and then there are more water channels that are pretty much always present in the basolateral membrane, so water diffuses into the blood because it's at the highest osmolality. Okay, so this is, do you think this is a relatively quick process or slow process? Okay, well, because, let me ask the question a little bit differently. Does this cell, when it receives a signal from ADH, does it have to build these aquaporins? Does it have to start protein synthesis? Does it have to find amino acids and a lot of ATP to put these aquaporins together? What are they? They're already made. They're just inactive because they're an endosome. So all the cell has to do is move these endosomes over and put it in the apical surface right here. So this is a relatively quick process because you don't have to build new aquaporins. All right, relatively quick process. All right, so the other take-home message here is the collecting duct, depending on the concentration of water, right, or how dehydrated or hydrated your blood is, it will regulate the amount of water that can be resorbed. So the proximal convoluted tubule is just working 100% all the time, but the distal tubules is what? Where your kidney can make fine adjustments to how much water the kidney is resorbing and putting back in your blood. All right, so that's a pretty important exam figure. Okay, so don't forget, secretion is what? Secretion is the opposite of resorption. So resorption is moving material from filtrate back into the blood. Secretion is moving things from blood into the filtrate. All right, so the excretion, right, is going to be a combination of filtration, resorption, and secretion is going to produce excretion. All right, so the active transport of substances from the peritubular capillaries into the tubular fluid is secretion. We haven't really talked about that very much. That's this yellow pathway right here. Secretion is opposite in direction that occurs during resorption. Right? Resorption decreases renal clearance and secretion increases renal clearance. So here is just a little equation. It's just a nice simple algebraic equation. So what's the excretion rate of some kind of substance like these solutes right here? It is the amount that it is filtrated by, the amount minus how much is resorbed, but also added to it is how much is secreted back into the filtrate, into the nephron. So the excretion rate is filtration plus secretion minus the resorption rate. All right, so you see your three processes, 1, 2, 3, for the production of urine. All right, so not all blood that's delivered into the glomerulus is filtered into the capsule, right? 20% is filtered, the remainder pass into the efferent arteriole, back into the circulation, right, like the peritubular capillaries. And there are substances that aren't filtered, but it can still be cleared by active transport. Let's talk about some, what about some good things that are filtered that you don't want to end up in urine? What are some good molecules, some beneficial molecules that are filtered, but you don't want to end up in urine? Glucose, a lot of water, get resorbed, okay? But there are still some toxic compounds that don't get filtered that stay in the circulatory system and end up in the peritubular capillaries, right? So it's stuff in blood that we would like to have in urine. We would like to excrete that. Like, for instance, nitrogenous compounds, especially urea, which comes from ammonia. Ammonia is very toxic. So there should be ways to take those harmful compounds that are in blood and put them into the tubules right here for excretion. All right, and that process we call tubular secretion. All right, so glucose, amino acids are normally 100 resorbed from the filtrate. Right, this occurs at a constant rate in the proximal convoluted tubule due to co-transport with sodium, like that diagram that we went over. All right, but don't forget that transporter displays saturation if glucose concentration is too high, and then glucose ends up in the urine if what? The transport maximum is exceeded. So the level needed to saturate the carriers for glucose is achieved at the maximum transport rate when they're all saturated. Glucose and amino acid transporters typically don't saturate in normal individuals, right? But if somebody has diabetes mellitus, then glucose concentration is way too high, and that's what happens. And then you end up with glucose in the urine. We call that glycosuria. You can read this slide for the numbers of where that happens. All right, let's talk about some electrolyte balance. We talked about water balance and how ADH controls that. All right, but the kidneys also regulate levels of sodium, potassium, as well as acid and chloride and phosphorus, right, by matching excretion to ingestion. So if you over-ingest these things, then your kidney is going to excrete them. The control of plasma sodium is important in regulation of blood volume and blood pressure, right? Control of plasma potassium is important for proper function of all excitable tissues like neurons and muscles, cardiac muscles and skeletal muscles have to have the proper potassium level. So what happens if potassium goes way too high? What's going to happen to a membrane? It's going to hyperpolarize, and then it is what? Driven away from threshold, so those cells can't be excited, right? So that's a way of inhibiting cells when they hyperpolarize. All right, so we're going to review some things that we looked at already, and that is a hormone called aldosterone. Right, and you should remember that aldosterone influences the sodium and potassium balance inside the cell. All right, so 90% of the filtered sodium and potassium, where does filtration take place again? In the renal corpuscle. 90% is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. Right. The remaining is variably reabsorbed in the distal tubule and the collecting duct depending on the body's needs. So if you're out drinking a lot of margaritas the night before and you have really high sodium, then you should secrete a lot or excrete a lot more sodium during the day. And it's regulated by aldosterone. So aldosterone controls potassium secretion and sodium resorption. Now, which way are these two going, potassium and sodium? Are they going in the same direction or opposite direction? Opposite direction. Yeah, so if you ever see a board exam question regarding aldosterone, okay, and you can't exactly remember which way it goes, always look for the answer where sodium and potassium are what? Opposite each other. All right, but hopefully you'll be able to remember, especially with a graphic, remember that it's sodium resorption and potassium secretion. So it's sodium retention in the body. Aldosterone promotes sodium retention, but what? Loss of potassium. All right, in the absence of aldosterone, 80% of the remaining sodium is resorbed in the distal tubule and collecting duct, but when there is aldosterone, all of the sodium is resorbed, right? So it can change the amount of sodium that's being resorbed. potassium. Let's change the subject for potassium just a little bit. So we have potassium entering the glomerulus. It gets filtered. Almost 100% gets resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. And if potassium levels are too high in the body, the kidney makes up for that high level of potassium by secreting it in the distal tubule. That's sort of interesting that it does that. But this secretion happens only under the influence of aldosterone. There has to be an aldosterone signal. Otherwise, what? Your body doesn't lose any potassium whatsoever. Okay, so here is that juxtaglomerular apparatus. So here we've got the nice nephron. So here is Bowman's capsule, proximal convoluted tubule, loop of Henle. Right, loop of Henle comes right between the afferent and efferent arteriole, right at the beginning of the distal convoluted tubule. And there are some specialized cells in this region right here. All right, so let's zoom in to this region. So here is the afferent arteriole. The afferent arteriole has got some smooth muscles around it. It's kind of like a pre-capillary sphincter that can control the flow through the glomerulus. And then here is the ascending loop of Henle. There are some modified cells of that tube, which we call the macula densa cells. And then there are some modified cells in the afferent arteriole that are called granular cells. We put these two kinds of cells together. We call that the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And that's going to help regulate blood flow through the nephron. All right, so remember the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism? Did you have that on the last test? Oh, I'm sure you did. No, it's on this one coming up. Okay. All right, so when this system becomes activated, it releases renin from the granular cells right here. Renin is put into the blood. So renin comes from the granular cells. And renin converts, all right, angiotensinogen. What can you tell me about angiotensinogen? It's inactive, right? It's at high concentration in the blood all the time. It's inactive, but it's ready to go to work at a moment's notice as soon as it receives a signal from these granular cells right here. And the name of that signal is renin. All right. Now, renin is just not a signaling compound. It's actually an enzyme that can convert, can chop off some amino acids from angiotensinogen and make it angiotensin 1. All right. Angiotensin 1 is not a very active compound. It gets converted into angiotensin 2 by ACE. And ACE is located primarily in the lungs, so blood has to go through the lungs. And then angiotensin 2 stimulates the release of aldosterone. Where does aldosterone come from? The adrenal cortex. The adrenal cortex. Okay, releases aldosterone. It's a mineralocorticoid. It's not a glucocorticoid like cortisol. A mineralocorticoid, which means what? It's going to help regulate minerals in your body, like sodium and potassium. Those are minerals. Okay. So inadequate intake of sodium chloride, that's a mineral, causes decreased blood volume. Right? Because that lower osmolality inhibits ADH secretion, causing less water reabsorption. And that low blood volume and renal blood flow stimulate renin release. Right? So that affects blood pressure, and that stimulates the granular cells. Okay, that decreased blood pressure stimulates granular cells, and also sympathetic nerves that go to the kidney, right, will cause constriction of that afferent arteriole. Okay, so let's look at this flow diagram right here. So low dietary intake of sodium, what produces a low osmolality in blood, low plasma sodium concentration. The hypothalamus can monitor that. It will send a signal to the posterior pituitary to decrease antidiuretic hormone. All right, so what is it, what's the kidney going to do as ADH decreases? It's going to produce more urine as a result, right? Antidiuretic is going to retain water, but when antidiuretic hormone goes away, you lose water. So decreased water reabsorption in the collecting duct, so it stays in the collecting ducts, it doesn't get reabsorbed, right? What allows water to be reabsorbed? What membrane protein? Can anybody remember? They got to review your notes a couple times. It's those aquaporins, back on that particular slide, right? So water gets trapped in the collecting duct. That increases urine volume. When what happens? There's low intake of sodium, right? So increase urine volume because water is trapped in the collecting duct. That decreases blood volume, right? And through the baroreceptor reflex, that stimulates the sympathetic nerve activity. That also stimulates the juxtaglomerular apparatus to release renin, and so does the sympathetic nerve activity, because there are sympathetic nerves that go to the kidney. Increased renin helps the conversion or promotes the conversion of angiotensinogen into angiotensin II through that. Don't forget all the steps that are involved. That goes to the adrenal cortex that causes secretion of aldosterone, and aldosterone then acts on the distal ducts of the nephron, in particular the collecting duct. And aldosterone causes increased sodium resorption. All right, but what's the effect on potassium? If aldosterone causes increased reabsorption of sodium, what does it do for potassium? Opposite way, right? So it increases the secretion of potassium into the collecting duct. All right, so then if sodium resorption is increased, that returns sodium to the blood, and you can see that subtracts from the initial stimulus. So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism helping regulate these electrolyte levels. All right, so here is the second figure in this chapter that's not in your book that shows the mechanism of aldosterone. And I want to go over at least the anatomy of this diagram so you can study it over the weekend. What do we got? Just like that other slide we have on the right, we have blood. The next compartment over is interstitial fluid. Right, the next compartment are the cells that make up the kidney tubule. And then we have the lumen of that kidney tubule, the collecting duct. Right, so we got the lumen, we've got the cells that make up the collecting duct, interstitial space, and then finally the capillary over here. So the signaling compound is aldosterone. And what can you tell me about aldosterone? This goes way back to like the first chapter. What kind of molecule is aldosterone? You should think of like that staircase step kind of looking molecule. It's a steroid. Yeah, I like that. It's a steroid molecule. And what's the nature of a steroid molecule? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It is hydrophobic. All right, since it's hydrophobic, what does that mean? It can actually enter the cell. So where's the receptor for a hydrophobic signaling molecule? It's intracellular, all right? And then the other thing maybe you could recall, when you have nuclear receptors or cytoplasmic receptors, what's the action that they perform on the cell? They usually can act as transcription factors which alter or can stimulate or increase what? Protein synthesis, right? Because transcription is which step in protein synthesis, number one or number two?
One.
Number one, transcription, and then what's the second one called? Translation, right? So aldosterone acts as a transcription factor, increasing protein synthesis. And then we'll look and see what the role of some of those proteins are inside the cell on Tuesday. So, okay, I don't know if we're going to get to reproductive system. If we don't get to reproductive system, that means that for the rest of your life, you'll have to pretend there's no such thing as sex, and you'll never have sex. Okay? But I think we have to get to it somehow.